Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. Are humans the enemy? Should pigs and peas have constitutional rights? Today on ID the Future, Joshua Youngkin continues his discussion on the new book and documentary film, The War on Humans, with the book's author, Discovery Institute Senior Fellow and bioethicist, Wesley J. Smith. Smith leads Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. In part three of this series, you'll hear about the movement to establish legal rights for animals and plants. Smith examines the meaning of the term personhood and its implications for human rights. Be sure to visit www.waronhumans.com to get more information about the digital book and the documentary.
The book that you have written, War on Humans, chronicles a lot of these changes in the law and in society. You've mentioned several of them. Which of them, I think, is the most imminent threat? Is it the animal rights movement? Is it the nature / plant rights? Which of them has you most concerned?
I think nature rights is the one that I think could cause the greatest human harm over the long term. In the near term, the real threat is animal rights because of an agenda in animal rights. It's called animal standing. That is, it seeks to allow animals to bring lawsuits in their own name against their owners. Can you imagine if you own a cattle herd and you're filling out liability insurance and the insurance question asks, have you ever been sued by your herd? Well, that sounds ridiculous and stupid, but you've got some people in very high places standing up for animal standing. Cass Sunstein, who until a little while ago was the regulation czar for the Obama administration before he entered government, said that he believed in animal standing. Lawrence Tribe, who was once talked about for the U.S. Supreme Court, he represented Al Gore in the Supreme Court against George Bush, a very notable Harvard law professor. He stood up for Stephen Wise, who has brought lawsuits on behalf of chimps to have them declared persons. There are more than 100 law schools in this country with animal rights law clinics who are training lawyers dedicated to the idea that animals have equal moral value to humans. And if you ended up with the ability to bring a lawsuit in the name of the animal, there's millions and millions of dollars available for people for the ethical treatment of animals, the Humane Society of the United States, which is not affiliated with your local Humane Society, people who seek to prevent the proper and humane use of animals for human benefit. And they would bring lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit. And there are plenty of lawyers willing to do that. You'd have these very big corporate firms that hire these idealistic lawyers, and they get them to do the corporate business by promising them free pro bono time in order to bring causes that they care about. That's why you see some very, quote, conservative law firms, very big corporate firms, bringing some very radical cases, because that's how they get the young associates to do the corporate work, by giving them the promise of this pro bono work. Plus, you'd have, I mean, Humane Society's got millions of dollars. PETA's got millions of dollars. You've got lawyers who would be happy to do it pro bono because they believe in the cause. So I think in the near term, the idea that an animal could be declared a person by a court, or a court would allow some kind of an animal lawsuit to be brought forward in the name of the animal, is the biggest threat we face to human exceptionalism in this area. I think even more immediate are issues of bioethics and healthcare law and the right to life and that kind of thing that are beyond the scope of my new book. But they're even more immediate. The idea that we're going to redefine death is just one example, not to be dead, but to be in a persistent vegetative state so that we can make instrumental use of the person who's in that condition by calling them a non-person. So in bioethics, you see this drive to have the most weak and vulnerable among us declared non-persons, which opens up the door to using them the way we might use a lab rat. Now, this sounds, you know, this is more than we would ever do. It's already beginning to happen. Not taking organs from people in PVS, but we are beginning to see real efforts to say that certain people are not allowed to have medical treatment based on their quality of life, which is part of this road to treating different people differently based on their capacities.
Right. Instead of their intrinsic humanity.
Exactly.
You used the word personhood a couple of times there, and that's a big concept in the law, and then the law has many areas. Isn't it the case that the law has a conception of personhood that varies according to its area? So you could be a person for the sake of habeas corpus, and a person, not a person, for the sake of campaign speech.
Yeah. You have, for example, corporations are deemed artificial persons, but corporations are human associations. So corporations are allowed to be, quote, persons, close quote. They're a human association for purposes of certain legal rights and juridical entities, tax reasons, and so forth. But everything that is a person now has a human being involved in it in some fashion. What is really radical and new is the idea that we should be able to have persons who are not human, be they animal or perhaps even based on the intrinsic dignity of plants for some reason. There was actually an advocacy article written in the New York Times, which means it's not totally out to lunch, saying that peas should be considered persons because peas are able to communicate through the soil about changing weather conditions. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think peas will ever be named persons, but the idea that this finds an advocacy in the op-ed pages of the New York Times and that a publisher let this professor write a book to that effect shows you the appeal to a certain ruling class or the intelligentsia, the academic set, to the idea that we must smash human exceptionalism and let people understand that humans are not unique, that we are not special, that we are just another species. And therefore, when people have that understanding, the idea thinking goes, they will treat the earth better. And I submit that's a folly, that if we think of ourselves as just another animal in the forest, that's how we're going to act. Because that means animals, they give into their impulses. They don't have principles. It's all based on the narrative of the moment or their instincts. Human beings, if we start thinking of ourselves that way, that will be a devolution rather than an evolution or an improvement, in my view, in human society.
Moral agency, of course, doesn't attach to most of the things that, like peas. Peas don't have moral agency.
Right, right.
But there are, as I understand, in the literature, favoring non-human rights.
Switzerland has declared in its constitution the intrinsic dignity of individual plants. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about ecosystems. We are talking about individual plants. And they even hired, they passed the law before they knew what they meant, of course. Yeah, this is the way things are these days. So they had a big bioethics committee decide why do plants have dignity. And they came up with a reason that is like a joke I've often told. When I've been in debates with neo-Darwinists who've told me that animal species are a fiction, different species, because we all evolved out of the same primordial ooze, we all share many of the same genes, and therefore it's a species, I've always said, well, if you really want to be reductionist, let's go all the way. Carrots are made of carbon molecules, and so are people, so there's no difference between us and carrots. Mm-hmm. That is the basis of Swiss advocacy now for individual dignity. This big brain bioethics committee said that the molecular similarity between plants and humans gives rise to the intrinsic moral value of plants. So my joke is now accepted reason for plant dignity in Switzerland. You can't get ahead of them because they always catch up to you.
The idea that rights are on a sliding scale that tracks along capacity. The greater your capacity for exercising a right, the greater the right should be attributed to you. Is that the basis for civil rights in the United States, for example?
Well, civil rights is based on human exceptionalism, the corollary to which is universal human equality. Mm-hmm. We have rights and values simply because we're human. We don't have to earn them. They come with the package. Martin Luther King said, "Let's judge us by the content of our character, not the color of our skin." The Declaration of Independence, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." That sentence has probably been the most impactful sentence of the last 300 years, because even the most totalitarian societies at least give lip service to that idea of human rights come from being human. The United Nations says each of us are born equal in dignity and rights. It's an assertion of objective value. What personhood theory does, or the idea that our rights come from the quality of our lives, the amount of our capacities, that turns human rights into a subjective issue instead of an objective issue. So that if a human is not a person because they're, let's say, incapable of valuing their life over time, which is one of the criterion that is often argued is a basis for rights, well, since not all humans can do that, then you're going to have human non-persons, and these non-persons are going to be deemed to have lower value than human persons. Who are the human non-persons in bioethics? Well, all unborn life, fetuses and embryos, they're not conscious, and an early embryo doesn't have a nervous system. But that also means that newborn infants are not persons under this view, which is why Peter Singer of Princeton University, the world's probably most famous bioethicist and moral philosopher who holds the most prestigious chair in that field at Princeton, believes that infanticide is moral because an infant has no greater value than a fetus who can be aborted, based not on disability or anything, but lack of capacities of personhood. Somebody like Terry Schiavo is deemed to have lost those capacities because of illness or injury. So if you accept the idea that we get rights based on quality of life, then some animals have greater rights than some people because some animals do have greater capacities than some people. And none of us is safe because that means our rights depend on our capacity of the moment to the moment to the moment. So in this moment, I have personhood. Therefore, I am safe. I have equal rights. If I walk outside on the street and slip on the sidewalk and hit my head, maybe I don't have those rights anymore because my capacities have become diminished. Very dangerous. And at the very least, it means there's no such thing as universal human rights, because that means there are some humans, because they don't have the capacities, that are denied those rights and those protections. That is the end of liberty. That is the end of protecting the weak and vulnerable. That means who matters is depends on who has the power to decide. That's what we've been striving against for the last 500 years in the West.
The death of the rule of law.
It is the death of the rule of law because it's not based on anything that's a solid principle that doesn't change. It floats depend on who has the power to decide at the moment. And it floats depending on your capacities at the moment.
I read a book when I was in law school called Race, Rights, and Recognition. And it was essentially written by a black philosopher at the University of Kansas named Derek Darby as a way to get the black community in particular away from using rights talk, in as much as it was grounded on the nature of the person, because it was bound up with talk of slavery in the past, because it had failed the civil rights movement in certain respects. That was sort of the justification. And what he wanted to do, instead of grounding rights in ontology, in the nature of things as they are, etc., was he wanted to ground it in social relations. The reason why all communities that exist as part of the larger political community that we call the United States, the reason why those members of those sub-communities are to be granted rights in the larger communities, because they're members of these smaller sub-political communities where a man can act, regardless of his skin color, as a father to a son and vice versa. And that sort of recognition is extended between all the communities. So that what you have in essence is rights grounded in social relations, the ability for a person or for any member to act as a member of a society, to extend rights and receive rights, to extend recognition and receive.
Right, but that means that people who don't have the capacity to do that are out. I think our rights should come just from being human. Once you accept that human exceptionalism, that being human is what gives value, you can then implement laws and relationships around that to help make that a better. Of course, we haven't achieved that. That would allow us to then, we don't have to say, well, you matter because you're in this social relationship or because you have the capacity to be in this social relationship. You matter because you're human. And that's something we can determine. Is this individual, is this organism, if you will, human? If that is human, then there are certain things you will not do to that organism.
A bright line rule.
For example, you will never treat that organism as an object.
Right.
That organism will always be a subject. But that doesn't mean that every single of those organisms can, for example, have the right to vote. Of course, that's not the same thing. But there should be a minimum level that you do not sink beneath based on someone being human.
Yes, sir.
That's, in my view, an objective view is the only way to truly guarantee that all human beings are brought into the human freedom that we have been striving for so long. But I'm worried that we're turning away from that view to one in which we're trying to come up with subjective reasons to protect certain communities, but that by nature and by definition excludes some humans. Once you've done that, you don't have universal human rights because not all humans are entitled to them.
So you, for the sake of protecting animals and for the sake of protecting the environment, et cetera, you like the idea of duties on humans rather than on increasing the regime rights to expand.
Right, because it's all about duties anyway. Animals don't have rights because animals don't have responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Let's say that we say that animals have a right to life. Will that prevent the lion from predating going after the zebra? No. Does the zebra have a right against the lion? No. Does the zebra have a right against us? Yes, but can the zebra bring it? No. Who would bring it? Us. So you'd end up with duties that are so self-sacrificing for humans, it would cause us tremendous harm. And there are times when we do sacrifice ourselves now for the benefit of the environment or to prevent animal cruelty. That's something we should do. And there's an argument to be made. What should be the extent of human duty based on our humanity? What kind of protection should we give this particular animal or that particular animal or this environment or that environment? That's a legitimate argument when it's based on human duty. But if it's based on rights, then you basically shrunk us in terms of our value. You've taken rights and you've turned it into such a broad concept that it becomes like money in a wild inflation. The idea of a right loses its value. If a squirrel hit on the road, which is always unfortunate, is the same as a child hit on the road, what have we become? Well, we don't really believe that, so we don't really believe in animal rights. I don't even think somebody from PETA would say if I hit a squirrel on the road with my car accidentally, I have the same duty to that squirrel as I would if I hit a child in the road. But if you have animal rights or nature rights, it's all coming down to human duty. But the nature rights and the animal rights make it an extreme human duty to treat those elements of the natural world as if they were us. And that is going to cause tremendous harm to human society and to human prospering.
What is motivating folks in law schools and elsewhere to take animal rights when they learn that the difference between lower animals and man is just a matter of degree and somewhat arbitrary or socially constructed or whatever the word they want to use? What's going on there?
I think that I'm betraying my age a bit, but I think that this idea of rights, which has really captured my generation, particularly civil rights, really captured my generation's heart and soul, Martin Luther King, that whole era. I think that there has been a march to take that same kind of idea and move it to the far extreme in terms of what should be applied to that. I think there's been also a turning against our own civilization because of our flaws. I think our flaws should be looked at as a way of improving them. But I think what has happened is that our flaws have been deemed so egregious that we are throwing the baby out with the bathwater, that we are rejecting everything that brought us to this level of unprecedented freedom, unprecedented liberty, unprecedented prosperity, unprecedented inclusion of others into society. All of those things did not come about by accident. They came about because of a belief in human exceptionalism. But there's now been a turning against that because it has not been perfectly applied. And rather than attack the areas where it's been imperfectly applied, we've attacked the very principle that allowed the progress we've made to actually occur. And if it's a form of decadence and it's a form of self-loathing. Yeah.
That's the end of part three of this series of interviews with Wesley J. Smith, author of the new digital book, The War on Humans, and contributor to the new documentary film of the same name. For more about the book and the film, be sure to visit www.waronhumans.com. That's www.waronhumans.com. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture.
ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.